2 Chronicles 21, I want to talk about the situation after the death of Jehoshaphat. Well, Jehoshaphat did mess up here and there, especially in his relationship with the house of Ahab, but he was a good man, we're told, that God thought that his heart was right with him. So we can look forward, I think, to seeing him in the kingdom. Well, he had 7 sons, which you could say was a great blessing, and he was very careful to name them all with God's name in their names. You can see them all listed in verse 2. Azariah, Yah, Jehiel, El, Zechariah, Azariah, Michael, El, Shephatiah. But he gives the kingdom to Jehoram, because he was the firstborn. But it says, verse 3, their father gave them great gifts of silver, gold, precious things, and the fortified cities. But the kingdom he gave to Jehoram. So you could see here a man who, Jehoshaphat, who did pretty well in life. In a sense, he ended up extremely wealthy. And he tries to name his children with God in their names. And he splits up his wealth amongst his kids, although Jehoram is going to be the king. So it all seems the ideal family, is it not? But one simple truth of life, one of the simplest truths, is that wealth does not bring happiness. Now, we keep on being reminded of this in the Bible and in the people we meet in life, that wealth doesn't bring happiness, but everybody wants to be rich. People sacrifice their relationships, their time with their spouse, their time with their children, because they want to get more money so that they can have a better this, that, or the other. And all stresses and so forth arise because of that, and relationships suffer. There's this sort of inverse relationship between wealth and quality of relationship. It's just as simple as that. And, well, here you see it yet again. Wealth didn't bring happiness to this family because Jehoram, when he became king, strengthened himself and killed all his brothers with the sword. Simple as that. And that is connected directly with the father having split up his wealth between the 7 sons, but the firstborn is to be the king. Well, the king wanted it all, so he just killed his 6 brothers and grabbed their silver, gold, and precious things. And this continues a theme when we read in verse 4, he strengthened himself. Quite often you read that phrase of how the kings of Judah strengthened themselves when they first became king. But then that human strength is tested by God or removed. And of course, what they should have done was to trust in God for his strength. The lesson to Chronicles 16 was that the eyes of God, the angels, run to and fro in the land to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is perfect toward him. God shows himself strong to those who are spiritually minded. That's the point, and yet these kings of Judah strengthen themselves rather than taking God's strength. Well, the problem was with Jehoram that we read in verse 6, he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, as did the house of Ahab, for he had the daughter of Ahab as his wife. So, this is the problem. His wife was Athaliah. And, you know, who fancies marrying the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel? Well, sure, she obviously had a bad influence upon him. And I just want to focus upon the way that Athaliah means Yah has constrained. We wonder why a daughter of Ahab and Jezebel absolutely hated Yahweh and Yahweh worship, why would she be called Athaliah? Yah has constrained. Well, I think that a lot of the names you read of in the Bible were probably not birth names. I mean, you read the name Mali a few times, which means sickly. I mean, who is going to name their baby boy sickly or weakling? No, this is what they became known as, and that is also seen in Anglo-Saxon name history, that people got a name in accordance with their life experience or in accordance with something that happened to them or their career that they did. That's why there's so many people called Smith or Walker or whatever, Taylor. Yeah? These people were named after what they did. And so it is, I think, with a lot of these biblical names. They came to reflect later characteristics or positions adopted rather than being birth names. So I think that Athaliah, Yah has constrained, this was a reflection of how she felt. That she felt that God was kind of boxing her in. And this is a very common attitude, is it not? Because a lot of people sort of resent God's, as it were, limitation of them. But the law of God is not a chain. The law is not a chain, it's not a leash. Because man is not a dog. And God is not treating us as his animal that must be restrained. I think Paul has something of this in mind when he writes to the Corinthians, you are not constrained by us. You are constrained actually only by your own conscience. So he's saying, look, I am not constraining you, neither is God. You are wrong to complain that we're trying to box you in and tie you down. It's not that, you know, man is the dog that's tied up outside the bar and it's covered in snow and poor dog is straining at the leash to get away. That is not how God actually is. That is how people wish to interpret him. That's how people wish to live because they refuse to actually do the right thing. And as Paul says, it is your conscience that makes you realize that the life of sin and dissipation is actually wrong. So you're not limited by God, you're limited by your own conscience. So God wishes us to be free. And I would argue that the ultimate promise of God to his children is of ultimate and radical freedom. What Paul calls in Romans 8, the glorious liberty of God's dear children. Now, in this life, we are friends of Jesus, but the metaphor of slavery is also used. That in the parables, for example, the Lord told, we are given wealth and we are to use it for the advancement of the work and cause of our master. And in the Lord's parable about the unjust steward, he comments, if you've not been faithful in that which is another man's, who will give you that which is your own? So as David said, all that we have is God's, and if we give anything to him, we give him what is his own anyway. But the time is coming when we shall be given, Jesus says, that which is your own. Now, of course, you are given that. You are given that by grace. But all the same, you are given that which is your own. Now we are stewards. I think that is the dominant kind of metaphor in the New Testament. We are stewards. We are given things to trade, to look after, etc. But the time is coming when we shall be given, and I stress the given, it is all of God's giving, we shall be given that which is our own. In other words, we shall become ultimately autonomous. And that desire for ultimate autonomy, ultimate freedom, is very strong in human nature. But as very often with us as humans, we're seeking for the right thing, we're asking the right questions, but we can't quite get the full answer in this life. You want that ultimate freedom, but you cannot escape the ties that bind of one sort or another, and you certainly cannot escape your own mortality. And yet the time is coming when we shall be given that glorious liberty to be and do as we wish. But, and this is not a catch, during this life, we will have developed the desire to simply want to go God's way, to do and be as he is. That is what we are going through this life for, to develop that desire. And so I can say that in the kingdom of God, yeah, all I want to do both now and then is to do his will, is to do his work, is to be his person. That's what I want with all my heart. That is my free will, genuine desire. My free will desire is not, for example, to live a sinful life, to do evil. It is to do good. That is true. But I'm constrained by my own weakness, by the nature, I suppose, that I allow to dominate me and so forth. And yet the day is coming when we shall be given that freedom, when we shall become finally autonomous and shall live forever and ever and ever. Believe me, this is the most wonderful hope. And this is what we should give absolutely all our strength, all our soul, all our might, all our heart. We should give for this.